So, welcome back, everybody. The class we've been doing for the last 5 weeks is Buddhism Back to Basics class. And the inspiration for the class was my noticing how many people in the United States claim to be Buddhists or interested in Buddhism, practitioners of Buddhist meditation, who couldn't actually tell you the most basic aspect of Buddhism, which is the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. It's the most basic summary of what Buddhism is. And I was really surprised to see how many people didn't know it. So over the last, the first week of this class, we talked about who Siddhartha Gautama was, or at least probably was. Then we talked about how we know things about the Buddha, how these texts have come down to us. I wonder if that will stop doing that. And then we've been talking about the Four Noble Truths. The third week, last week, Chuladasa was supposed to talk about the first four of the Eightfold Path. He took an incredibly slow pace, so I think we have like at least nine of the folds left to go today. So I'm gonna try to make it through, and I'm gonna be very respectful of the clock because, as you know, I've been lifting things for 11 hours, and I think by 8:30 I'll be ready to go, and I'm sure some of you will as well. So the Eightfold Path is divided into three parts, and the first is right view, and this is what we talked about last week. So largely won't be talking about this today, but the idea of right view is the intellectual knowledge about the Dharma. And this is helpful for a number of reasons. The second component of the Eightfold Path is generally called morality. I don't really like the term morality so much. Especially for those of us who grew up with Christianity, it can have kind of a harsh tone to it. It can have sort of a patronizing tone. You know, I know what's right, you don't know what's right. I think if I got to rename the morality component, it would be don't do stupid things. There's a reason I would pick specifically don't do stupid things. This is why. So how is it that so many people claim to be Buddhist and not know the Eightfold Path? There's a fad that's been present in this country for a few decades that recently has been named mindfulness. It's sort of the one-fold path. It's the idea that if you have any feelings, you should practice mindful acceptance of these feelings. It's not very well defined. And you should probably meditate. And if only you meditated more, you wouldn't have these feelings. There are a lot of corporations now that have taken on mindfulness. And it would be great to think that some of these corporations really care about the mental health or spiritual progress of their workers, and I'm sure some of them do. But there's a belief that meditation is going to make you more productive, make you a better capitalist, make you a better employee, and sort of get your employees to meditate, and they'll be better employees. I don't know how this movement's going to pan out, whether mindfulness is going to make you realize when you're doing stupid things, or whether it really is possible to just become more productive. But irrespective of this, this idea of mindfulness is kind of the one-fold path, or maybe something like half a fold. And it doesn't involve the idea of changing your behavior, so you stop doing the same stupid things that you've always been doing. There's a notion in Buddhism that probably everyone's heard of, which is karma. And there's many different ways that you can talk about karma. It's incredibly complicated. The Buddha said you will never ever be able to understand it. It's so complicated. But one way you could think about it is that what you do determines who you are, and who you are determines what you do. And these things go in a in a reciprocal cycle. So there's a cycle. I'm a psychologist, so this was on my mind yesterday. There's a cycle of depression, or not necessarily, you know, meeting the clinical criteria for depression, but depression are just sort of the blues, sadness, where being depressed makes you want to stay at home, do nothing, and not see anybody. And staying at home, not seeing anybody, and lying in bed makes you depressed, which makes you more likely to do nothing, which makes you more depressed. And this can just snowball. And probably most of us have seen this, either in ourselves or in somebody else. The way that this snowballs into doing things that are not skillful, doing things that don't work, that feel like they ought to work, but don't, turning you into a person who's more likely to do that, and then you do it, which turns you more into a person like that. But you can break this cycle. You can, there's a lot of different ways you can break this cycle, but one way you can break this cycle is forcing yourself to get out, forcing yourself to go to the gym, even though you don't feel like it. Be around people, excuse me, even though that doesn't feel like it. And what a lot of people find is that this depression starts going away when you start acting differently. And that the less depressed you are, the easier it is to do the things that you enjoy. So there's these negative feedback loops where we do things that seem like good ideas, but really make things worse for us and make us more likely to do these wrong things in the future. But there's also positive feedback loops. You can do smarter things that make you a more skillful, happier person in the future and more likely to keep doing that. So that's how I think about the morality component of the path, is stopping the things we've been doing that haven't worked very well, replacing them with things that work better, and starting these kind of positive feedback loops that are going to help us in our meditation, that are going to help us in our life. The first of the three components of morality is right speech. And there's two traditional formulations for right speech. The first is to avoid speech which is harsh, speech which is divisive, idle chatter and gossip, and have no notes for today. Harsh, divisive, oh, false. Harsh, divisive, false, and idle or pointless. This idea of avoiding harsh speech, it seems almost silly that anybody would need to tell you to do it. It seems like an obvious thing to do. Raise your hand if you think you should avoid harsh speech. Keep your hand up if you consistently avoid harsh speech. Womp, womp, womp. There go the hands. So, what we'll be talking about in the morality component of the path are lifelong practices. The idea of never speaking harshly, we know it's a great idea, but we're not there. And I think of these things as lifelong practices because your speech can always be less harsh. That you can get to a place where you virtually never yell at anybody, where you virtually never, use curse words aggressively, things like that. But there's so many different layers of harshness, layers by which your communication can be hurtful, and
remind me of that cord. You may try a different mic. Yeah,
it might be that it's tangled up. Let me see if I can untangle the cord.
I thought you were just enjoying the lightsaber.
Let's see if that fits. Ooh, that sounds good for the moment. So there's a story from the Buddhist canon that I spoke about on the first week, where the Buddha gives a retreat on the disgustingness or the repulsiveness of the body. And after this retreat, he himself goes into silent retreat. And a whole bunch of people commit suicide. It was so depressing to hear about how gross the body was, Wouldn't you like to get rid of it if it's so disgusting? I like to think of this example as certainly the Buddha had no intention towards speaking in a way that was harsh or hurtful. But the way I would interpret the story is he just didn't know that this was a way that was going to be hurtful. Divisive speech is a really hard one. In Buddhism, there's a list of, there's not seven of them, I think there's five, but there's the sort of deadly sins, the unforgivably bad things that you can do. And four of these things are largely mythological things, like wounding a Buddha or killing an arhat, things that you're not very likely to do between now and the end of the day. The one thing on the list that isn't mythological in character is creating a schism in the Sangha, is driving the community of practitioners apart. But you can't just invite everybody in, can you? Some people just don't behave themselves. And this idea of how do we use speech in a way that is not divisive, even though we know not everybody's welcome in here right now. You know, some people cannot behave themselves. This out there. And they might come in here and we might need to tell them about acting differently. Okay. False speech. Seems like, again, this thing that seems super obvious, but that has all these gradations to it of as we get to know ourselves progressively better. It becomes easier, I think, to avoid false speech. The last is idle speech or gossip. Obviously, you can see why gossip is wrong. It's awfully fun. When you get together with Dharma teachers, you often find that they're all talking about one another. It's awfully hard to avoid. I had never kind of gotten why gossip and idle speech were the same thing. They seem like kind of different vices. Really, just now when I'm talking, it's starting to make sense to me. Thinking about why, when you get together with all these Dharma teachers, they seem to have so much fun talking about other people. You just want something to talk about when you get together, don't you? And you can talk about how your week's been going. You can talk about yourself. Talk about the Dharma. We do an awful lot of that. But man, if you just want to keep the conversation going, talking about other people's lives sure does have that effect, doesn't it? The idea of idle speech, I think, is probably the most challenging. Who here's been on a silent meditation retreat? Cool, cool. So when you go on retreat, you don't on many styles of retreat, you don't observe absolute silence. So you talk to the teacher about your practice. If they're serving food and you're allergic to peanuts, you don't just eat the thing and mindfully die of anaphylactic shock, right? You ask them if there's peanuts in it. So in many traditions, you're not forbidden from speaking. You're forbidden from speaking anything that isn't immediately important and relevant. And the result of this is you may go days at a time in silence. There's a tendency to just want to talk when we're around other people, to want to talk. And for many of us, there's a tendency to do this at home, to leave the TV on, leave the radio on, so that somebody's talking somewhere. The Buddha says, Buddha's like silence. Buddha's like peaceful, secluded places. There are so many contemplative traditions in the world. And maybe the most unifying factor among all the world's contemplative practices is silence. That while most people, most contemplative traditions do have chanting in them, every contemplative tradition I can think of values silence to a degree that those of us in the mainstream world probably don't. So this idea of idle speech is challenging because you want to have something to say when you're in a group. It's fun to talk to people. But if you just start letting your speech ramble, it can often turn into gossip. And it has this effect of interrupting the silence. I'm thinking now about the idea of right speech in the sense of the karmic snowball. That if somebody who isn't here today, we start talking about them, how are we going to feel around them the next time that we see them? How have we set ourselves up to be less loving, less compassionate, less close, less happy around this person the next time we see them? You know, they're doing their thing, they're changing, but we have some concept of them. And when we speak negatively about somebody, we're really perpetuating in our own minds this negativity. We're also, and this is a theme to to all of the Fools and Eightfold Path, we really underscore this sense of self with each of the instances of wrong speech. When we speak harshly, where does that come from? You know, I'm right and you're wrong. I know what you should have done and you didn't do it. Where does gossip come from? You know, we talk about other people's romance, other people's relationships. There was a teacher, I'm pretty sure he's passed away now, named Menindra, and he got in trouble for sleeping with a student, which is something unfortunately too common. And his first Dharma talk, when he met with his students after this came out, he sat down and said, "Who here has not made a fool out of themselves through sexuality?" No hands went up. When you talk about how badly other people are behaving, it comes from this place of putting yourself above everybody else, being very separate. I behave myself really well over here, and these people behave badly over there. What happens when you leave that room? Now everyone's talking about how badly you're behaving. All the folds of the Eightfold Path I'm a post-nasal drip. Should have seen the pre-nasal drip, though. It's all been uphill since that. All the folds of the Eightfold Path work together in the same ways. One of these ways is improving karma, is creating these positive snowballs instead of the negative one. Another of the ways is helping you see non-self, helping you see interdependence, helping you see unity more clearly. And so this is, it's another reason that I've criticized the One-Fold Path or make mindfulness. You can sit on the cushion all you want. If you go to work the next day and you're lying to people and you're yelling at people and you're gossiping about people, you're undoing all that good work that you just did on the cushion. The same way as putting hot and cold together, everything ends up lukewarm. It doesn't matter how hot you make something, it's got a comparable amount of cold, everything comes back to baseline. The second component of morality is right action. Right action is usually defined by the five precepts. If you want to convert to Buddhism, to become a Buddhist, different traditions have different ways of doing this, have different numbers of precepts, different levels at which you can take vows, but these five precepts are pretty much universal to all of Buddhism. And the precepts are to refrain from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, wrong speech, and deliberately, so it's written as taking wines or liquors, but I think of it more as deliberately creating mental illness. Probably if your grandma offers you a glass of wine, this isn't going to prevent your future enlightenment. So and pretty much anybody who converts to Buddhism takes at least these five precepts, and the precepts existed before the time of Buddha as well. And each of the precepts has both gross and subtle aspects. And for those of us who come to meditation classes, the gross aspects are really not things that are particularly relevant to us. So the gross aspect of refrain from killing, probably none of us kill people very frequently, and the gross aspect of this isn't going to be so tremendously revelatory, where, you know, perhaps you were a serial killer and you heard this, you know, sweaty, dirty guy in his work clothes with his blanket on tell you to stop killing people and now you've sworn off it. Although the Buddha actually does convert a serial killer to a monk in his lifetime. But, you know, I don't think any of us are him. So, I'm trying to talk. But the subtle levels get progressively subtler. Something I've been struggling with quite a bit recently is the idea of eating meat, or even eating dairy products. Because, you know, in order for the cows to give milk, they have to have babies, and you can't take care of an infant and a baby, so there's slaughter involved in that, too. There's a certain tradition of Buddhism, I can't recall which one, where the first thing you're told when you get to the monastery is you cannot eat without killing. Go think about that. Another theme of the morality, the whole morality component of the Eightfold Path, is that we have to interact with the world in order to survive, and we have to cause suffering to others by interacting with the world. You cannot eat without killing something. You could be a vegetarian, but dairy involves a lot of death. You could be a vegan, but now you're eating GMO soybeans. If you think of the massive amount of death that was created to plow the fields, destroy what was there in the past. If you think of the massive amount of suffering of agricultural laborers who picked your soybeans, it's very hard to find a way around somehow buying into the system. So, you know, we can think about not killing in the sense of, you know, literally not killing people. We can think of not killing in terms of not personally killing animals. And in some forms of Tibetan Buddhism, this is actually the rule. Is it's okay to eat meat, but you shouldn't kill anything. That to kill something involves turning off a part of yourself that you don't want to ever have to turn off. So if the meat has passed between three hands from the person who killed it and you, then it becomes okay to eat the meat. So how do we solve this this problem of not killing when we need to eat? And I think, honestly, this is a personal choice that each of us has to make. And that, as far as Buddhism's viewpoint, this question of should you be vegetarian is probably one of the oldest arguments in Buddhism, or should you be vegan? And I don't think there's an answer to it. I think there's been lots of arguments about this, and no clear answer. The Dalai Lama is not a vegetarian. But I think what Buddhism would require of you is to know why you're not a vegetarian, to consider the amount of harm that you do through your eating, and to consider how best to mitigate it in a way that it can help you keep you alive. One more way I like to think about not killing, he said, destroying a piece of equipment. One more way I like to think about not killing is in terms of just destruction, of seeing things we don't like and trying to get rid of it, both in ourselves and in other people, that when we find something, some part of ourselves that we truly hate and just want it to go away, this kind of has the flavor of killing to it, of wanting to destroy some part of yourself, wanting to destroy some part of your partner, of your boss. I've had this feeling that the kind of ancient primal process in the back of the brain that wants to kill things we don't like is maybe getting channeled into trying to destroy other things. The clock keeps moving. They tell us time is a delusion, but this thing moves just as quickly as we go. anyway. The second precept is not to steal, or usually phrases, not to take that which is not freely given. And again, probably none of us hold up convenience stores. But what I've been doing in my own practice is besides internet downloads, seeing how much better I can get at this. You know, I'm at my friend's house and there's a piece of fruit. I'm quite certain he would tell me I could have that piece of fruit, and he won't miss that piece of fruit. So it's really not an aspect of morality. You know, there's very little moral to be said about eating a piece of fruit in your friend's house. But this concept of karma is to give the other person the amount of respect and love to say, do you mind if I eat this thing? This is setting you in a positive direction. I was in the shower a couple days ago, and I was joined by a companion who was a scorpion. And I was really unhappy to have a scorpion in the shower. And my first thought was, well, I should kill this scorpion. It's, you know, it's poisonous, and here it is in my shower. But I had this idea that I would try the Buddhist thing and see if I could catch a scorpion. It might bite me, but it might bite me if I kill it. So I caught it, and I brought it out to the desert, and I let it run away. And I don't know what the lifespan of a scorpion is. I don't know if I did that scorpion much good. You know, they might live for a couple weeks anyway. I may not have extended his life all that much, or maybe her life, you know. But I came back in feeling a lot more connected to nature, a lot more connected to everyone around me, a lot more respectful of life. It's the same concept with all of the precepts. It's not necessarily about morality. The moral implications of killing something poisonous in your house beyond the scope of this discussion, but I would say are not black and white. but it sets you in this positive feedback loop to everyone more closely see the way that you're taking things that haven't been offered to you. I gave a Dharma talk on Tuesday about sex in Buddhism. It was a lot of fun. We don't have time for it now, but the Buddha was opposed to sex for the monks. There's a really kind of raunchy in the Vinaya. There's a really kind of raunchy sutra where one of the monks had sex with the woman he had been married to. And there's a list of the places it would be preferable to insert your penis than a woman. the mouth of a viper, a pit of flaming coals. The Buddha's view on sexuality, at least for the monks, was quite low. But for the lay people didn't take a vow of celibacy. Nowadays, in the West, very few of us take a vow of celibacy. And so this idea of sexual misconduct is something that becomes important. Again, the gross things like, you know, don't have sex with children, don't have sex with non-consenting people, probably not relevant for us here. But it becomes awfully easy to hurt people through sex, doesn't it? You come in with the absolute best of intentions and it ends disastrously. And it feels like this can happen a lot. So, I think one way that it becomes easy to commit this more subtle sexual misconduct is having sex with somebody who you aren't sure is on the same page as you. So, for instance, having sex with somebody who might be in love with you if you don't feel that way about them. Or vice versa, if you're in love with them and they don't feel that way about you. Having sex with somebody you don't know well enough to tell if they're on the same page as you. There was a number of cultural and socio-political reasons that the Buddha was so opposed to the monks having sex. The monks were beggars, and they would go into the town and as holy people, and that was the only way they got fed, was saying they're holy people and asking for food, and probably if you're going in and sleeping with the townswomen, it would have been a lot more challenging to convince people. feed you, and probably much more importantly, if you're having spouses and babies, it's a lot more mouths to. But I think another reason that the Buddha was so down on sex for the monks is that the second noble truth is that tana, often translated as craving, is the root of all suffering. And looking at your craving to deeply understand it is a way out of suffering. Acting on your craving doesn't just cause suffering. Acting on your craving is suffering, both for you and for the people around you. And sexual craving, no matter what age you're at, seems to be one of the strongest motivators that people experience. If you think of from a biological perspective, why are you here? You come from 100,000 generations of people who were good at eating food, not stepping around snakes, and having sex with each other. If this wasn't very strongly programmed into your mind, you wouldn't be here. And when this craving gets strong, the inclination, of course, is to act on the craving, and not to see people for who they are, not to see people perhaps as equal with you, to see another person as a means to an end. And the karma of seeing another person as a means to an end is about as bad a karma as anybody is able to accrue. Most of the horrors we can think of in human history have been from viewing another person as a means to them. So on each, so you know, often you would have a whole Dharma talk on sexual misconduct, or a whole Dharma talk on right action. So forgive me for, you know, necessarily having to speed through, but I just hope to get across some of the layers in which you might think about these precepts. And if you were ever interested in formally taking the precepts, which is where you become a Buddhist, it's a very beautiful. It's a very beautiful ceremony. I found it extremely helpful in committing myself to a living. The fourth precept is wrong speech, and we'll skip over that one. Except to say, I had mentioned the formulation of wrong speech as speech that is false, harsh, divisive, or idle slash gossip. There's one more formulation of right speech, which is speech that is true, useful, and this is the kicker, timely. That one's awful hard. The Buddha claims to only speak that which is true, useful, and timely. There's a Meatloaf song called Two Out of Three Ain't Bad. Finally, there's abstaining from intoxicants. And in a traditional Buddhist setting, traditional Theravada Buddhist setting, this quite literally means don't drink anything, don't do any drugs. I really don't like that interpretation at all for several reasons. The point of this, as far as I can tell, is to avoid mental dullness. So you come home from a long day at work, your body feels terrible because you've been acting in a way at work that doesn't make your body feel very good. So you have a few glasses of beer, so you no longer notice the consequences of your previous actions, and you dull your mind to have no idea what's happening. You have less of an idea of what's happening. And it certainly makes sense to me that we wouldn't want to create dullness this way. But meditation largely came to the Western Hemisphere through the psychedelic movement, through people who used quite a lot of drugs, and found that it didn't lead to mental dullness. It led to the most awake states they'd ever been in. And I'm personally not a fan of alcohol, when I do occasionally drink it, usually make it feel dull and dopey, but I have had some very kind of lucid awake moments with that as well. So I think as far as actual use of substances, it really matters what your intention is. Of course, the Buddha says, when I say karma, I mean intention. And so it doesn't mean never drink. It means why are you drinking? You know, grandma poured you a glass of wine and she'll be offended. You know, I don't think you spend a thousand lives in a hell realm if you take the glass. But are you drinking to avoid something in your mind? Are you drinking to avoid acting responsibly? You know, you can do much dumber things and make an excuse for it.
sure a lot of us know people who do not.
I think the other reason that I like defining this more broadly is don't drink. Really, I mean, for those of us who aren't in recovery, don't drink is really not a lifelong practice. You know, it's got a solid end. You can just stop drinking and don't do it anymore. And unless you have an addiction to it, done and done, moving on to, you know, what's the next fold? Moving on. I've been finding that, you know, I did quit drinking, and I've found ways to replace it with other things. This computer next to me, this is my new drink. I've had a bad day and I don't really notice it. I can stare at this thing for hours. I'll turn it on just to send an email. 3.5 hours later, I have no idea what I turned it on for. The email hasn't been sent. I've read 20 articles on topics that I don't care about. The word Buddha literally means somebody who is awake. And putting ourselves to sleep in any way is creating the karma to do this again. Shula Das has been repeating this quote recently. You can't get enough of something that almost works. So what happens when you drink the beer? Well, it does feel pleasant, doesn't it? Zoning out on the internet, it does kind of feel nice. It's not solving your problem. You need to do it again and probably more the next time. All the causes that led you to a place where you just wanted to disappear are still present. You probably magnified them by the mental illness. And so every time you move away from reality, instead of moving towards insight, instead of moving towards seeing reality clearly, you're seeing reality as solid, you're over here, it's over there, you need to get the hell away from it, and you reinforce this. And each time you reinforce it, it kind of works, so it makes you want to reinforce it even more next time. So this, for me, is a lifelong practice. Finding how do you shy away from reality. There's a very common and wrong view of Buddhism or of meditation that it's about getting happier. And I find that this is one of these lessons of Buddhism that I've learned 1,000 times and I just keep forgetting it. The path isn't about being happier. Well, at least not in the conventional sense of being happier. As in having more pleasant mental experiences. Insight is available in every moment. Is anybody familiar with Eckhart Tolle, Power of Now? So he talks about his enlightenment coming through severe depression. He had an insight in the midst of an intense depression. And this led him to a place where suffering was, you know, he claims that it's gone or if it's diminished, but whatever place it led him to is a good place. He's quite wealthy, he sold a lot of books, even if he's still suffering just as much. Rich fellow now, he's friends with Oprah. Anytime we move away from our experience, we're creating a sense of self, pretending that suffering is coming from outside, and moving away from the insight that is ripe in every moment. The first noble truth is that life is dukkha. If dukkha makes you bail, if dukkha makes you try to fly away and wait until you get something happier, this is not the path. Understanding suffering, being with suffering, seeing it so deeply that you get to know it, get to know where it's coming from, get to memorize it, this is much more on the path than dullness is moving away from that. The last component of the morality part of the path is right livelihood. And in the sutras, right livelihood again has a pretty narrow definition, which I think I can recall. Don't sell poison, don't sell weapons, don't sell meat, and don't sell people. Again, probably most of us here don't do that. And if you work in a supermarket, you really have 1,000 lifetimes of hell ahead of you. I'd like to hope not, but you know, they sell an awful lot of meat in the supermarket. To me, the idea of right livelihood is this. for those of us who aren't beggars, and you couldn't have a culture of all beggars, right? The culture has to be mostly not beggars, or begging's not going to be very successful. For those that aren't beggars, we have to get money out of the world. And there's a lot of craving tied up with money. We probably all have some. And maybe some of us will be completely free of all craving by the end of our lifetimes. But I would go out on a limb and say that no one in this room will be free of craving by tomorrow. And so tomorrow you're going to have to go out into the world and try to get things from it. Try to make it give you things. The idea of right livelihood is, how do you minimize the suffering in something that's bound to cause suffering? Any dollar that goes to you is a dollar that didn't go to somebody else. If you invest your money and it goes up, you know, it's because somebody else sold theirs and theirs is going down. Every dollar that comes to you is a dollar not coming to somebody else. So I would see right livelihood as this similar component of even a Buddha needs food, needs nowadays money to buy food or money to buy the land on which to grow food. And it's the practice of, we would love to be just giving to the world, you know. The next class, which will start in 2 weeks, is on the Brahma Viharas. The Brahma Vihara translates to something like divine abode. It's qualities that you cannot have enough of that are infinitely beneficial. The more you have, the better. And is loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And it would be great to have nothing but compassion for everybody all the time, to do nothing but try to help others. But we need to get money, and every dollar we get is a dollar somebody else doesn't get. This becomes a lifelong practice. How do you get what you need from the world to support yourself in a way that is ever more genuine? So I'm a psychologist, so for a little while I had written this one off. I'd chant the precepts, and I'd say, right livelihood, you know, I'm a psychologist. Check, that's a very nice thing to do. Helping people, get some money, even too much money, perfect. But man, there's a lot of different ways you can be a psychologist. There's a lot of different ways you can relate to it. Damn clock. The last component of the path is meditation. The first component of the meditation, folks, is right effort. And this is really the one that gets the least airtime in your average meditation class. The traditional definition of right effort is like a 2x2 matrix. Take all the qualities in you that are good and get more of them, and all the qualities not in you that are good and bring them in, and all the qualities you have that are bad, get them out, and all the qualities you don't have that are bad, keep them out. You may often hear the directions of meditation of something along the lines of just sit there. Meditation's about non-doing, non-striving. We're not trying to get anywhere or achieve anything. And there's some very good reasons that somebody might give those directions. They kind of pull you in the right direction. You know, if you sit down, too much striving, the idea of doing less, non-striving, pulling you in the right direction. But that's not what the Buddha said about meditation. He didn't say that there's no goal, that there's nothing to do. Meditation has an ethical component. In your meditation, you should be trying to make yourself a better person. To me, it looks something like this. When you find hatred arising in your meditation, you can't tell it to go away. In fact, telling it to go away, it's just another form of hatred. Like hatred and hatred. But you can say to it, hello, old friend. Welcome back. You can stay as long as you want. There's the door. Don't let it hit you in a good moment, split you. Allowing it in, but inviting it to go as soon as it's ready. And when love arises, realize that this is equally impermanent. Hatred may well be up next, but saying to it, you know, welcome back, please stay as long as you're willing to. Simply setting the intention to allow positive mind states to expand to whatever degree they will, and to allow negative ones to contract
to whatever degree they will.
The Buddha has quite polarized speeches on his view on friendship. On one hand, he'll say something like, "Dear ones who endear bring suffering. If you have three close friends, you have three problems. Two close friends, two. One close friend, one. Zero close friends, zero problems." On the other hand, there's this beautiful, very short sutra called Half of the Holy Life, where Ananda says to the Buddha, "Isn't it wonderful, Lord, that good friends, noble companions is half of the holy life?" And Buddha says, "Do not say that, Ananda. Do not say that. Noble friends, admirable companions, this is the whole of the holy life. So with noble friends and admirable companions is certain to develop the Eightfold Path." I like this second viewpoint better. So this idea of bring in the good things that you don't have and get rid of the bring in the good qualities that you don't have and keep out the bad qualities that you don't have. Certainly this can be done in meditation, but a large portion of it is who you hang out with. Even if you're really around somebody with the intent of reforming them, Gandhi writes quite a bit about this. Bad traits are more contagious than good ones. He writes about as a young man trying to be friends with somebody to reform him and finding that it largely went in the opposite direction. So to me, right effort has this component of choosing the right sangha, being around the right people so that these qualities that you don't have, you bring in the good ones, you progressively upgrade. Nuts, I want to talk about this for another 3 hours. Moving on. One more thing I would say about right effort. There's a metaphor in the sutras where somebody's meditating and he's kind of freaking out. And he had been a musician before he became a monk. And the Buddha came to talk to him to calm him down. And he said, "Back when you were a musician, if the strings on your lute were too loose, how did it sound?" And so, "Well, it sounded bad." "Well, if the strings were too tight, how did it sound?" "It sounded bad." "And what if the strings were perfectly tuned?" "Well, then it sounded good." And this is another way of thinking of right effort in meditation, that it's really not about non-doing and just being. But if you sit there forcing yourself to enlightenment, forcing, you know, "Love, you better show up in my mind. I am so sick of this." something like that is probably the wrong direction to go also. We want to keep the mind awake and alert. We want to bring in the energy to make this happen. But, you know, I told you I'm moving things for 11 hours today. Energy's not going to happen today. I'm just going to be fighting. Seeing the ways in which, you know, I don't think you ever get to a place where you have right effort in this sense. I think it's a constant adjustment every time you're meditating of, am I trying too hard or am I trying too little? And when you get these polarizing speeches from the Buddha, from Dharma teachers, this is largely why. Ajahn Chah says, when people say to him, "Why do you say opposite things?" He said, "Well, you know, if you're driving your car too far on the right of the road, I'm going to tell you to swerve left, and if she's too far left, I'm going to tell her to swerve right." So this idea of do nothing is largely pulling people towards the middle. I think these polarized views on friendships are largely, it's not that the Buddha truly holds two opposite views, but he's trying to make a point to the person that he's talking to. The seventh component of the Eightfold Path is right concentration. This is something that gets a little more airtime. In early Buddhism, actually throughout most of the history of Buddhism, there were three trainings that you would get as a Buddhist. The first was morality. We don't even talk about meditation until you get good at right action, until you get good at being a good person. This is where it all starts. To have an angry mind and sit there quietly with an angry mind, it's just going to make you an angrier person. Sitting on a cushion is as likely to be bad for you as good for you, absent anything else. The second training is right concentration. The third was right mindfulness. Nowadays, we teach mindfulness. If you really hang out for a while, we'll teach you concentration, and morality is kind of gets very little play. The traditional definition of right concentration is states called jhanas, J-H-A-N-A. The word jhana has a lot of meanings. It literally just means meditation. but it's a series of refined states of concentration, of absorptions. You may have had the experience if you're a musician, if you're an artist, if there's something that you love to do that you're pretty good at, of getting completely absorbed in this, of reality, the outside world kind of falls away, the boundary between you and this activity fall away, and things are just free and easy and energizing. And this is maybe a decent metaphor for what a jhana state is like. It's quite absorptive and delightful, and you largely forget about other things that are going on while you're sort of absorption. There's a list of which jhanas you can get into. Most people say there's 8 jhanas, but even some of those people have lists that have more than 8 things on them. People will agree with 8, but disagree about which 8. I'm not going to go into this at all. I don't know much benefit in trying to describe these states. If you've been there, that's great. And if you haven't, you know what I'm talking about. And I've only been to a few of them, and I don't want to tell you things about what I'm talking about. So we'll move on from the jhana states. But I would say another way you can think about right concentration is there has, throughout the history of Buddhism, been a path that involves very little concentration. And as you come deeper into your own mind, you'll start having what Buddhists call purifications, which is the same thing that psychoanalysts would call catharsis, where emotions that have been buried in your mind for an awfully long time come up with a vengeance, and not necessarily for a minute, although a minute of this would feel like an eternity, but these things can last for a while, with sort of darkness from your mind coming back out. When you start seeing, when you start having insight, when you start seeing the sense in which all the outside world is unsatisfying, is constantly changing, in a sense, not really there. In a sense, not really there. This can also be very harsh. And one of the many benefits of concentration is it gives you something to hold on to, something stable amidst the turmoil of life. Chris was asking before the meditation, well, my concentration gets good, and then I lose it. It's good, and then I lose it. And this is a pretty common experience, because concentration is impermanent. Insight, in a sense, isn't impermanent. I mean, it's impermanent in the sense that you get Alzheimer's disease, you know, I don't know how long your insight will, but as long as your brain is reasonably well-functioning, insight is not impermanent. concentration is very state-dependent. So try staying up for 2 days and concentrating, you know? Doesn't matter how long you've been meditating. Try getting the flu. But think about the fastest person in the world. When he stubs his toe, he's going to go way slower than he's accustomed to going. He'll probably still go faster than the rest of us. He's still going to go a lot faster than he did before training. And when he recovers from that, he's going to be probably just as fast as he was beforehand. Concentration is largely like this. It can feel like you've completely lost it. And this is actually a normal part of the path, to feel as though you've completely lost it. The experience of feeling like you've never meditated a day in your life when you've been doing this for years. I know very few meditators who haven't had that experience. Concentration can actually lead to purification. Purifications most often lead to non-concentration. So there's this funky thing where the effect of non-concentration, if you're really doing it well, can be non-concentration. It's a funky thing to find. But does anyone find this familiar, that concentration can lead you to non-concentration? Alright, cool. I'm glad I'm not the only one. So it's never something that's going to build linearly, because if you're really doing it well, it's bringing up insight, it's bringing up your own psychological stuff. If you're really doing it well, it will knock you out of concentration, But all the skill that you develop is still there, the same way the world's fastest person has really developed all that skill, even though when he gets the flu, he's awfully slow until the flu passes. So I would say that the benefit of concentration is it's very calming, it's very stabilizing. Mindfulness is one way you could think about it is shining a light in the mind. And concentration is turning up the battery life and the watt of your light so that you can shine it brighter and you can shine it longer. The more that you can put your attention wherever you decided to put your attention. The downside of concentration is it's impermanent. It's not freedom from suffering. Because it comes and goes. I have 3 minutes to tell you all what mindfulness is. I can speak really fast if you can listen really fast. I don't know where to go with this. There's a lot of different definitions of mindfulness. And really, to give you even a cursory overview of what mindfulness means would absorb the entirety of the hour. The simplest thing I can say about mindfulness is mindfulness is not forgetting the context. So in our meditation here, the breath is in the front, but everything else ought to be there in the back. So that the breath is arising in the context of everything else that is happening. Particularly for novice meditators, Chula Dasa will say, if you can't hear the fridge going on and off, you're not doing it right. He wouldn't say that. You ought to be able to hear ambient sounds. So mindfulness in daily life looks something like we come home from work, we get angry at the person we live with, and we yell. Mindfulness is anger is arising. Perhaps they have done something that they shouldn't have done. They had a long day at work too. They went through some stuff. I do stupid things sometimes too. Is yelling at this person really going to have any effect on them doing less stupid things in the future? And sometimes the answer is yes, usually not, but sometimes the answer is yes. One way of thinking about mindfulness is if you keep the context of here I am, noticing the arising of anger in a world with all these other things going on, it makes it a lot easier to decide what to do with the anger. Next time you're meditating, you have an itch. Go a couple breaths before you scratch it. Notice that an itch generally is a scratch. There's no space. Itching means scratching. Well, that, I mean, unless you got the chicken pox or a bug bite or something, that's probably fine. But see all the ways in your life where there's a similar pattern. You know? Craving means taking a drink. Getting angry means yelling at somebody. The space of what do I want to do with this craving? How do I want to use this anger? What do I want to do next? Disappears when the context collapses. This is not particularly similar at all to the classical definition of mindfulness, but I think it's a pretty useful definition of mindfulness. The closest thing I can get to a 3-minute definition of mindfulness. But notice that even in this 3-minute definition of mindfulness, the anger is still arising. There's a lot of different ways you'll hear the word mindfulness nowadays. And perhaps the funniest one is mindfulness the insult. That if you're experiencing negativity, you're not really being mindful. This is the opposite. The path isn't taking you away from negativity. The path is taking you towards understanding. And mindfulness involves feeling the negativity more strongly than usual. Let me just close with one of example of mindfulness. There was a study I heard about. I've never seen a citation. I think it's a real study. It doesn't matter if it's a real study. It's a good story. So they bring meditators and non-meditators into a lab, and they do something to really stress them out. And they hook them up to some machines that are measuring how stressed out they are. And they find that during a stressful experience, the meditators are in worse shape than the control group. But immediately after the stressful experience, the meditators are right back where they started. The non-meditators, so the meditators kind of look like this. They go up right back down. The non-meditators go down like this. Supposedly there's one person in the study who 8 weeks later
was still freaking out because of this festival experience that they put me through instead. Mindfulness means feeling the negativity more strongly, but remembering the context, noticing when it's gone. Noticing how I began our meditation with that everything in this room right now is perfect. The temperature, I mean, it's a little warm, but you know, the temperature is decent, there's lovely people around us, topics of conversation. But probably most of us have experienced some suffering while I've been in here, because our minds are taking us to all sorts of places that aren't perfect. Go on and go to bed, what's for dinner, why did you say that thing in 1987, and so on, and so on, and so on. So when we see the context of my mind is creating this idiotic mental talk and otherwise beautiful experience, life's pretty great, isn't it? It doesn't matter what crazy places your mind takes you to. Life's pretty great most of the time. If you're able to simply keep the context open or undertake a lifelong practice, you might even say getting progressively less bad at having the context collapse on you.